This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have right here in the studio with me David Cooper, the legendary former police chief of Madison, Wisconsin, who pioneered community policing here. He's got a new book out called Arrested Development. A veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and seven steps necessary to improve our nation's police. A lot of the advice is right up to the minute. David Cooper, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt.
Let's get a little background on you. I read in the beginning that you were a Marine first and then decided to become a police officer. How did that go?
Well, yes, I was a Marine for 4 years and got off active duty and then decided to go back home and get a degree so I could go back in as an officer because you had to have a college degree. So I really liked the Marines, and then I had to come back and try to find a job that would I could work at night. And they always said there's two jobs that Marines can usually do, either continue to be a janitor as you were when you were on active duty or be a cop. So I joined a local police department and worked essentially nights and went to classes during the daytime at the University of Minnesota.
And this was in the late 50s, early 60s?
Yes, 1960 it was, yeah.
And so, you know, you were right there as the civil rights movement was taking off, and then
Yes. You
could see some of the abusive police tactics in the South, the hoses, the police dogs. What was your reaction as a police officer seeing those?
Well, that was probably one of the stellar moments in my career to get home from work and from school and then watch the 6 o'clock news, which was the big thing. Everybody watched the 6 o'clock news and to see what was going on in the South. And it really outraged me. I was growing up in pretty much all-white Minnesota at that time. Knew very few blacks. I had one black student in my high school, but when I went in the Marines, I was in the minority. My recruit company platoon was predominantly Asian and black, and us white guys were in the minority. And that was a significant learning experience for me.
You write in the book also that when you were a kid, you went south with your family and saw the segregated drinking fountains, and that made an impression on you.
Yes, that I remember. That is clear. That was one of those images that I had to put in the book. I remember we stopped at the southern town and I went to get a drink of water, and I got out of the car, and I must have been maybe 6 or 7 or so, and it said white and colored, and I just didn't know what to do, and I had to go back to the car and ask my dad, what do I do? And that really bothered me that in America we had two separate drinking fountains.
How did he explain it to you?
He just said, well, you use the white one, son.
And was he enlightened on issues of race?
I think he was pretty good. I think I remember very little racist commentary from either of my parents. He was a preacher's kid, and I think he... He minded his business. He was a salesman. Didn't do well in managing money, but I think us kids survived.
And then, so then you saw like Bull Connor. What was your reaction, and what did your fellow police officers think of that?
Well, that's where the demarcation line started in Minneapolis when I went there after I was 2 years at this suburb of Minneapolis called Edina. Because those of us that were going to the university, and we had a group called the College Cops, and we started to have different ideas and started speaking out, and there was a significant difference between the old timers, and many of them were my dad's age, and us young guys in our 20s, who had been in the military, who had gotten out, and then the GI Bill came in, and we then were able financially, because if it wasn't for the GI Bill, probably would have never been able to afford to go to college.
So this group of college cops saw things differently than the traditional
Well, yes. We started meeting. We started speaking out. We wrote letters to the editor. I got called into the chief's office more than once and especially an article that I wrote that after the President's Commission came out in 1967 about the importance of community relations units. When are we going to do that in Minneapolis? When are we going to start a community relations unit and start interacting with the black community in Minneapolis at that time?
This was the Kerner Report, right?
No, that was before Kerner. Came, you know, after the trouble in the cities about, and they found that we are, you know, two nations, one black and one white.
That's right. Yeah. And then where were you when Chicago 68 happened, and how did you react to that?
Well, let's see, 68, I had gotten a year off to wind up my master's degree, and I had gotten a fellowship from the National Institute of Mental Health and was on campus during that time. So had a lot of friends who were in the SDS, and I remember seeing that poster in 68. It said, Chicago, Yippie, 68. And I remember, what's going on in Chicago that Yippie was the Youth International Party? I mean, so, you know, my fellow students, I think, you know, really educated me, and I had a sense of where they were coming from. I guess I had my perspective greatly broadened from where I was as a young sergeant coming out of the Marines.
And then in Madison in the late 60s and early 70s, there were notorious busts of protests. I mean, the mayor of Madison still, Paul Soglin, who's been in and out of the mayor's office, had his head cracked open. At a protest, I believe, against Dow Chemical.
Yes.
Where were you during all that?
Well, I was in Minneapolis at that time, and then had gone to another suburb as the chief in Burnsville, and that was the place where we tried out community policing, neighborhood policing. We didn't wear military uniforms. We wore blazers and slacks. We really toned down the image of police officers. We started the idea of joining a domestic peace corps. We were looking for college graduates, and that department today is still one of the 1% of departments in the United States that require a 4-year college degree for its police officers.
And when did you get to Madison?
Well, I got in Madison right at the end of 1972, after about a year selection process in which I was kind of the outside guy and wasn't expected to be appointed.
You're the counterculture choice?
Yeah, I guess so.
And you faced a lot of resistance, you said, at the police department in Madison. I don't need to get into the details of that, but it's interesting. Throughout your book, you write about the subculture of being a police officer.
Yes.
And being a police officer in a particular department.
Yeah.
And how it can be, the culture itself can be corrupting. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, it can be overwhelming. I mean, it is the culture. I mean, when you're working with somebody, you know, especially I worked at a tactical squad in a high crime area in Minneapolis. My life was really in my partner's hands, and I write in the book that I was closer with my partner than I was with my wife at the time, and that I came to the understanding that if he did something wrong, I could no more give him up than I could my own mother. And then I realized that I'm really deep into this culture. I've got to get some perspective. I've got to have some friends who are in other fields. I can't just hang around with police all the time. And I think that has helped me over the years to keep a foot outside of the subculture and see, you know, what's going on. And when it came to how we were going to handle protest, you know, I knew there were some different ways. The University of Minnesota sent me to Europe to look at European policing. That was enormous opportunity. I saw women officers in uniform on patrol, which we didn't have in our country at this time in 1969. I saw police working at different methods to handle protests. The police in Amsterdam handling the boat people and the large influx of the drug culture there, and not going crazy about it.
We've gone crazy about the drug culture here in this country.
We've gone crazy, yeah. We've gone crazy. We've lost the war. We need to do some major rethinking on a national basis of what we're going to do. We cannot continue like New York City arresting 50,000 people a year for possession of small amounts of marijuana. It's got to stop.
And nationally, it's something like 700,000 a year.
It's incredible.
Are you for legalizing or decriminalizing drugs?
Well, you know, we did decriminalize marijuana possession in Madison for many, many years. We said if you're caught with small amounts of marijuana in public, it's going to be confiscated. You're going to get a ticket. You've got to behave yourself. If you want to smoke marijuana in a home, the police are not going to be knocking on your door and sending dogs around trying to find out what you're doing inside there. I think that made a big difference in how we were going to be supported by the student community and the younger community in Madison.
But nationally now, if a police officer thinks he or she smells marijuana wafting out of the door at someone's apartment or house, they can bang in the door and go arrest someone.
Yeah. I mean, it's silly. The police know it's silly now, too. And what I'm hoping that a book like this will give police some courage to speak out. There is a national group called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. They're on Facebook, and they are speaking up, and a lot of them get censured by that.
The book we're talking about is Arrested Development. A veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and seven steps necessary to improve our nation's police. The author with me today, David Cooper. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What's it going to take to get over this so-called war on drugs?
Well, I think, you know, I talk about in the book, there's four major obstacles: anti-intellectualism, the quickness to use force, corruption, and discourtesy as the four major obstacles. If we can overcome those, police can get unarrested and start moving forward. And the end result is we're going to get smart, restrained, honest, and courteous police officers. And
this is regardless whether it's the war on drugs or anything.
That's right. That's right. And I think this is a national dialogue that's got to happen. We've got to have a conversation about our nation's police. The longer we put off this conversation, we haven't had one for about 40 years right now. Kerner Commission sort of shook us out of that. And just before the year before the Kerner Commission, we had a national President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice came out some radical ideas like cops should be educated, we should work with our communities, we've got to bring minorities onto police departments. What they failed to see was the role of women, which I thought was quite interesting. 1967, they never thought that women would ever be working on patrol. And today, in many of our cities, Madison probably, I think, the highest, 35% of the officers on the Madison Police Department.
And did you meet a lot of resistance when you tried to sexually integrate the force?
That's right. Well, we forget about those battles. The first women that were hired are heroes, are champions of the highest order. The crap they took.
What was some of it like?
Unbelievable. Porno magazines left in their squad cars, tricks played on them, de-minimizing their worth on the department. And women worked hard and did a great job to the point they are today of being accepted.
Did a lot of them quit and just say, I can't deal with this crap?
Not too many. And I guess one of the reasons, at least they've told me, that as that first wave of women retired, they said, you know, we knew you always had our back. You know, that, and it might have been tough in the ranks and maybe in the first rank of supervision, but they knew that I was committed to seeing them succeed.
So they were trailblazers. You were a trailblazer, too. Anti-intellectualism is one of the four recurring obstacles you talk about in this book called Arrested Development. Why don't you expand on that a little bit?
Okay. One of the things that I've seen is that we don't seem to remember what we've learned. We don't use our knowledge as a building block in the field. There is today, actually here in Madison, a National Center of Problem-Oriented Policing, which is an idea to what are the best known methods. They're doing work in this area. Some officers get excited about it, but it doesn't become the way in which business is done. If you don't have people that basically understand the academic process, that are just craftspersons who who learn the techniques of policing by retired police who serve in the junior college or something, if they don't have the traditional liberal arts education, I think it seriously hampers them as police officers. They've got to know about philosophy, economics, sociology, psychology, take a music and an art course. They need to be broad people because we're talking about basic, fundamental human rights. And the people who best protect that are the men and women of our police departments. If you wait to go to court or to the Supreme Court to protect your rights, you waited a long time, and somebody should have intervened before you had to go that far.
But sometimes it's the police that violate your rights, and one of the other obstacles you talk about here is violence or police brutality. I'm speaking with David Cooper, former police chief in Madison, who's got this very important new book out called Arrested Development. It's 20 years now since the acquittal in the Rodney King case. What was your reaction just watching that tape?
Well, I remember that that morning very clearly when that tape first came out. We played it at a staff meeting, and it was consensus among all the command staff there that was outrageous. What they wanted to know, where was the sergeant? Where was a senior officer who says, stop, this has gone too far? The subculture just got carried away that day. And, you know, if you just get on YouTube and Google police misconduct, I think at last count there is something like 10,000. Some of them are absolutely egregious. They are the videotapes from the police departments themselves about the propensity to use force in getting the job done. And I think there are many alternatives. If force is your only, you know, arrow in your quiver, then or if you're a hammer, then all the world quickly looks like a nail, you get in trouble. I think police can negotiate. I think we should look at not the technology to better policing in America, but the police officer, him or herself. That this is more an interpersonal task than it is about using technology to catch bad guys.
It's interesting that you're mentioning technology because you also write in your book, Arrested Development, David Cooper, about 9/11.
Yep.
And that 9/11 changed, this is a direct quote, changed our nation's police for the worst. I was surprised to come across that. I mean, when once I read it, it rang absolutely true. But why don't you talk about that?
Well, first of all, 9/11 was a day that I'm sure that historians 100 years from now will say that this one event not only was a terrorist attack on our country, but terrified our country.
Where were you then?
Well, I who doesn't remember? I happened to be in I was down in El Paso, Texas, teaching a course in a church there. I had already retired, and it took me 3 days to get home and by various buses. And it was a significant journey. My wife finally drove down and picked me up in St. Louis. But I think we also had our daughter living just a short distance. They would catch the subway from the World Trade Center often to go to work. Mm-hmm. And that day they left early. So I could have had a daughter and a son-in-law as a casualty in that. That was a terrifying day for me. But I think it's rippled into our society. I think we're a frightened society. I think we look at the fact that we've got to do things like surveil Muslim Americans. We've got to have like carry guns. We've got to have Newcastle Doctrine laws, and we're going to have things like Trayvon Martin happen because we are a nation afraid. We've got to start ratcheting things down. We need a police that is very low-keyed, sensitive, helpful, and courteous that can help establish the balance here. We need to send the military to do military things, but don't expect the police to do military intelligence, to have military weapons, and to do things that the military ought to do.
I mean, the NYPD, acts like it's the NYCIA. I mean, they have not only militarized, they've gone undercover in mosques and restaurants and public places, and even went spying on people as far south as New Orleans. That's a dramatic change in traditional police.
And operations. I think recently they finally relieved an officer from NYPD who had a seat in the CIA, had a desk at the CIA. I think that's going too too far in this. And we've just had now the authorization by the FAA for drones, you know, and there are a number of police departments who are applying for drones now. So let's see now. Is this an easy way to police an American city? Let's see, we'll have a drone keeping an eye on people, and then we don't have to worry about getting people to support the police and to work together in neighborhoods. But we all want to have a safe society. We want to help one another. You know, that's where we start the slippery slope.
We're pretty far down, I think, when I read a sheriff in North Dakota called in a drone to wrestle up three people were stealing cattle off a ranch or something. It's that kind of craziness. You mentioned, David Cooper, Stand Your Ground and the Castle Doctrine, the Trayvon Martin case. Now, the NRA and this group, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, yes, has been pushing these so-called Castle Doctrine or Stand Your Ground laws that are now on the books in many states. In Florida, you can go shoot someone in the middle of the street if you think the person is threatening you. In Wisconsin, Scott Walker passed a law that said you can shoot someone who is on your property, not even in your home, you know, in your driveway, mm-hmm, in your swimming pool, the statute is saying, and also in your car or in your place of work. Yeah. As a police officer, as a former police chief, what do you make of this? Are the police officers in favor of such things?
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. I would expect the nation's police leaders to speak out loud and clear against this. I thought that that the so-called relationship between police and the NRA would have come to an end when the NRA supported Teflon bullets, that they did not they would not let Teflon bullets be banned. Teflon bullets were created for the specific purpose of penetrating Kevlar vests that police officers wear. But we seem to be very quiet about that. I think this business about letting untrained people in our state now, there's no requirements for carrying a weapon. Police officers have to be highly trained and competent in using firearms. The Castle Doctrine can do nothing but make our community unsafe, not to help it be safe, and it's the police officers that have to work in an environment that is becoming more and more armed, and I think that's dangerous for our nation's police.
And the whole idea of the Stand Your Ground law is that you can use force just about as a first resort, and correct me if I'm wrong, but good policing, you use force as a last resort, or common sense, you use force as a last resort.
That's right. We should always, even if we have to leave the scene of a conflict. I mean, that's what your mom and dad told you when you were a kid in the playground. Hey, if people are starting fights, get out of there.
There was a young man killed in Wisconsin under the Castle Doctrine, and the homeowner shot him because he was on the porch who was trying to run away from police who were busting a drinking party.
And we were about 300 feet away, which a 911 call would have perhaps summoned the police to come and sort out who this young man was in the back porch.
Yeah, and whatever happened to, hey, kid, get out of my porch, get out of my lawn.
Get out here, I'm going to call the cops.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy where we've come to. Yeah. The other thing that's really concerning me, and I think you're well-equipped, probably better than almost anyone in the country to talk about, is the way that police are handling the Occupy movement and the protests going on there. I'm speaking with David Cooper. He's the author of Arrested Development. He was a great police chief in Madison, really engineered, pioneered community policing. But we saw, and you write about in your book, the picture of those UC Davis, that UC Davis cop walking down the line of those kids who were just sitting down or holding hands nonviolently and just pepper spraying him at point blank range in the face, or the New York City cop who did the same thing at the Occupy to those two young women.
Yes.
What goes through that cop's mind that allows him or her to do that, and why have we returned to this kind of policing?
Well, that was exactly my question. I remember seeing that in the paper that morning. I turned to my wife, who was a retired police officer, and I said, what in the world was he thinking? So what in the world was he thinking at that time to think that that type of force was appropriate in that situation? I don't know.
And he wasn't stopped by the other officers, right?
No, it said, well, this is crazy. You know, stop this, you know, which we've all, I think everybody who's worked on the street has certainly intervened at one time or another. A police officer was getting too hot or too heavy. Just stand back. Hey, I'll just calm down. Gave some words of calming, because sometimes in these situations you need to calm your colleagues as much as you do the people that you're policing out there.
Now, that UC Davis cop and the whole system has come under scrutiny. And in fact, they did a report, I think, the UC system, blaming the chancellor and blaming everyone involved in the whole chain of command. But it just seems to me that in this day and age, that police forces are looking at protest as something that needs to be crushed rather than protesters as citizens who have a right under the Constitution to be out there. And not as enemies. Yeah. And yet there's back to almost a Chicago 68, protesters are the enemy, cops are the pigs. You know, do you feel like there's a sort of turning back the clock there?
Well, I think one of my chapters is that what goes around comes around. You know, the wheel goes round and round, and these issues do have a tendency to come back to us. I remember, you know, my first major demonstration in Madison, the sheriff's department was there, the university, my staff was there, and at that time, my assistant, who was one of the candidates for my job at the time, turned to me and said, "Well, I hope you're not going to allow these students to get into the street on this demonstration, because we, chief, have fought long and hard to prevent them, keeping them out of the street." And I looked at that as a direct challenge, but also a chance to do a teaching moment. And I said, "Well, this is how I look at it. Students are protesting. That is a right under our Constitution. I think that Constitution trumps local traffic laws. So I don't think that I want us to fight over whether or not people are going to go into the street. Instead, I think our job is to facilitate this protest." And that, of course, was headlines. Half the town thought, "Well, finally at last." And the other half said, "My gosh, well, what is he talking about?"
He is David Cooper. He's my guest today on Progressive Radio. His book is Arrested Development. A veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and 7 steps necessary to improve our nation's police. We've got less than 2 minutes left, so we can't go through all 7 steps, but can you talk about one of them, one of the most important steps?
Well, I think let's look at the leadership one. I think, and one thing we did in Madison, we changed the leadership style from a top-down coercive style to more of a collaborative leadership style that not only listened to the community, but also listened to our employees. And I think policing is too hierarchical today. I think we rely on coercion to get the job done rather than work with the officers. If the leaders of police officers are not treating them with dignity and respect, it's highly unlikely that they're going to treat the citizens they come in contact every day with dignity and respect. And I think that's one thing we missed for years. When we finally saw that we need to listen to our employees, it made a big, big difference. Planning together, letting some decisions be rank-and-file decisions. And to this day, this might be hard to believe, but to this day, the head of the Madison Police Union sits on the management team of the police department because we think that voice is important.
That's almost a German style of labor management cooperation. Now you're no longer a police chief, but a clergyman. We've got about 15 seconds left. Do you miss being a police chief?
Well, no. I think it was time to leave. I think that that the beliefs I have got put in place. I think they've been sustained now for almost 20 years. That's the main thing, is Madison has been able to, with me being gone for 20 years, sustained what they've done. I think other police departments can do this. The model is there. It works. They need to start a conversation right now with their police.
We're going to leave it at that. The book is Arrested Development. My guest has been David Cooper. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.